Centre for Economics and Business Research predicts in 2022, a typical UK family will spend £1,700 more per year on household costs, with the inflation rate rising to its highest in a decade.
It's going to be hard for people to live. It will. It will. Especially the elderly. Especially the elderly. Yeah, all right, they may get a pension, but that's nothing.
We were just commenting, just coming down here now, the price of petrol still hasn't gone back down again. You know, it seems once it's gone up, it's just continuing.
It's not just, I'm already worried about it, because we can see there's lots of problems with energy companies that are going bust, and my own did as well, and it's been transferred, and I've seen the prices, and they are astronomical.
These are hard times in Britain, with Brexit-related fuel, food and retail delivery shortages leaving more than half the British population feeling Brexit is going badly. But in the press, it's not all doom and gloom. The BBC says the UK economy is set to grow at its fastest rate in more than 70 years. The Telegraph says British growth has surpassed China for the first time in 40 years. And according to The Express, the UK economy is set to outperform every Eurozone nation with double the growth of Germany. So what do the experts say about such forecasts?
Yes, of course, you're going to see an immediate bounce back in the economy, because that's what happens when you shut it down. It bounces back. The key element happens after that. Where does the sustained growth come from? And what you're talking about now from the Chancellor in the government saying a 6% growth next year and thereafter, no, that's not going to happen. It's going to be a much, much slower level of growth, and probably in the region of maybe 2-3%, something like that. So what you've got the government doing is talking up the economy, and you can understand why they want to try and do it, because they want to try and increase confidence.
Are big businesses confident to stay and operate in the UK? Are Britons confident to start up their own small businesses and keep the wheels of the economy turning? Only time will tell.
Of course, we cannot ignore the fact that we are still in the grips of a global pandemic. Tens of thousands of people have died in the UK as a result of COVID-19, even though it was the first country to start vaccinating. Lockdown after lockdown have taken their toll, and now we have the new Omicron variant.
The hospitality industry is reeling from the government's mixed messages over Omicron ahead of Christmas. It's forecast to lose £300 million worth of trade over the holidays, and some businesses have decided to close already due to staffing issues, cancellations, and an overall downturn in trade. So for them, this comes far too late in the day.
We don't think today that there is enough evidence to justify any tougher measures before Christmas.
According to the OECD, the British economy is recovering and expected to reach pre-crisis levels at the beginning of 2022. But growth will rely primarily on household spending. The average family spends 29% more in the weeks before Christmas. And that might be why, despite Omicron, the government has chosen to accelerate the booster jab rollout and not cancel Christmas. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme's done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe, since the aid reaches only a very small number of people, and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operating expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of the conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in December, during which the president often touches on acute international problems and suggests ways to solve them. The statements made by the Russian president during this event are prompted by politicians from different countries, in particular by the opponents of Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Show of Iranian military might in Israeli saber-rattling. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired 16 ballistic missiles in a fitting conclusion to its latest exercises. The IRGC confirmed that the missile hit and destroyed their intended targets with 100% accuracy. Five-day drills, dubbed Great Prophet 17, also featured a variety of combat and reconnaissance drones, sophisticated ballistic and cruise missiles, and attack helicopters. Advanced homegrown tank, dubbed Karar, also debuted in the exercises. The joint maneuvers involved IRGC's ground, naval, and aerospace divisions and spanned over Iran's southern coastline almost entirely, including Hormozgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz provided the maritime setting for Iranian forces to show their might. Iran regularly holds military exercises to maintain its combat readiness and deter any act of aggression. It says the maneuvers carry a message of peace and security for its neighbors and friendly countries. But this time around, the drills carried greater significance amid escalating anti-Iran rhetoric by Israel. The IRGC chief did not mince his words, describing the exercises as an authentic warning to Israel.
These maneuvers, particularly today's exercises, carried a very clear and explicit message, and that's a serious, real, and battlefield warning to the Zionist regime's officials, who have repeatedly issued anti-Iran threats, to beware of their mistakes and errors. In case of a misstep by them, we will cut off their hands.
General Salami stressed that all it takes to turn the drills into an actual military campaign is readjusting the direction the missiles are fired in. Israel and its main backer, the U.S., have repeatedly and overtly in recent weeks warned of a military offensive against the Islamic Republic, despite the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal, with Israeli President Isaac Herzog saying that Iran's nuclear program must be neutralized once and for all, with or without an agreement. It's widely believed that such threats lack credibility and serve as a mere leverage to extract concessions from Iran around the negotiating table. The Iranian negotiators, however, can confidently and nonchalantly stand their ground with such display of military prowess and deterrence backing them up.
Visiting Afghanistan's largest children's hospital in Kabul. These days, the hospital is receiving malnourished babies more than any time before. Doctors here say malnutrition has increased since the poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan, adding the hospital lacks beds and medicines.
The patients in our malnutrition wards have recently increased. There aren't enough rooms for them. Sometimes we have to place more than one patient on an individual bed. If the ongoing shortage of food and nutrition continues, more and more children will face malnutrition.
World countries should help Afghan malnourished mothers and children. It's obvious to all what's going on in Afghanistan. Our breadwinners are jobless as winter bites. Children and mothers are being malnourished as food is not brought to table.
According to UNICEF, 3.2 million children under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year. Authorities say world countries should not leave Afghan children alone.
Definitely, our hospital has been suffering from bad impacts of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has seized what belongs to Afghan innocent people, and it is a cruel attempt. I demand the international community to send their humanitarian aid to Afghan people today as they used to help our nation under the previous government.
Following the Taliban took over of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S.
The war may be over in Afghanistan, but the nation now is struggling with an economic crisis. Half of the population of Afghanistan is facing acute hunger, and over 1 million Afghan children are at risk of dying. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkish lira gained 20% on Monday following a speech by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The recovery followed a series of decisions announced by the president in a presser after the cabinet meeting. He said the new measures will encourage Turks to keep their savings in local currency instead of exchanging it to US dollar and euro.
We are presenting a new financial alternative to citizens who want to alleviate their concerns stemming from the rise in exchange rates when they evaluate their savings. Investors will be encouraged to move towards Turkish lira-based assets by issuance of government bills that are indexed to public economic enterprise revenues that are transferred to the budget.
Erdogan also said the Turkish government will help exporters who find it difficult to present the prices and foreign exchange rates due to fluctuation. He said that the government goes ahead with its lower interest rates plan as promised. The Turkish lira was at 18.4 against the US dollar before the president's speech and stood at 11.3 after it. The lira gaining value rapidly forced people to exchange the US dollar they had into Turkish lira in fear that the rate will go further down. However, the lira lost some of this value Tuesday morning and stood at 13.4 against the US dollar. No one here expected Erdogan's speech to have such an impact. Despite the wild swings, the lira is still down more than 40% against the dollar year to date. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres landed in Beirut on Sunday to follow up several issues, including Lebanon's economic crisis. In a press conference, he described as saddening and heartbreaking the situation in Lebanon.
I am also gravely concerned about the impact of the economic and financial crisis in the country, causing ever more people to need humanitarian assistance. Yesterday, I visited Tripoli in North Lebanon, and today Tyre in the south. And I was very moved when listening to first-hand testimonies about the crisis is impacting people's daily lives.
During his visit, the United Nations chief met President Michel Aoun and stressed that the United Nations stands in solidarity with Lebanon in its crisis. After meeting with Speaker Nabih Berri, the head of the UN recognized the Israeli violations of Lebanon's airspace.
The opportunity to discuss the presence of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, the need to end with all violations of the ceasefire, and in particular, the speaker has drawn my attention to the violations of the airspace of Lebanon, and also the need for total implementation of the resolutions of the Security Council.
The UN chief called on the Lebanese political leaders to show unity in order to carry out fundamental reforms and continue talks with the International Monetary Fund. Analysts question whether the UN can have any tangible impact on the situation in Lebanon in light of U.S. sanctions and Israeli violations.
The question we need to ask today is, can the UN change the reality on the ground, especially since there are U.S. economic sanctions and there are daily Israeli violations against Lebanon? Up until now, we have not seen any practical measures from the UN to at least stop these violations and the injustice which the Lebanese people are subject to because of its support for the resistance and its fight to have full sovereignty over its country.
Guterres also visited Prime Minister Najib Mikati and lauded Lebanon's generosity in being a place where Syrians and Palestinians took refuge. The United Nations chief urged the international community to provide more financial assistance to Lebanon, which is grappling with a myriad of crises, especially an unprecedented economic collapse. Yet most Lebanese doubt that these words would be translated into measures to stop U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Shanghai Cooperation Organization's 20th anniversary summit heralded the beginning of a new geopolitical and geoeconomic order, says Pepe Escobar, journalist, in an article titled "Eurasian Consolidation Ends U.S. Unipolar Moment." Stay tuned for more. The 20th anniversary summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in Dushanbe, Tajikistan, enshrined nothing less than a new geopolitical paradigm. Iran, now a full SCO member, was restored to its traditionally prominent Eurasian role following the recent $400 billion trade and development deal struck with China. Afghanistan was the main topic, with all players agreeing on the path ahead, as detailed in the Dushanbe Declaration. And all Eurasian integration paths are now converging in unison towards the new geopolitical and geoeconomic paradigm. Call it a multipolar development dynamic in synergy with China's Belt and Road Initiative. The Dushanbe Declaration was quite explicit on what Eurasian players are aiming at: a more representative, democratic, just, and multipolar world order based on universally recognized principles of international law, cultural and civilizational diversity, mutually beneficial and equal cooperation of states under the central coordinating role of the UN. from Southwest Asia to Central Asia, A Real Reset has as its protagonists the SCO, the Eurasia Economic Union, the BRI, and the Russia-China Strategic Partnership. Iran and Afghanistan, the missing links heretofore, for different reasons, are now fully incorporated into chessboard. Imperial hegemony, as interpreted by Washington, in its growing confrontation with China, a ruthless Washington has demonstrated that what matters to it now is not Europe, but the Indo-Pacific region. That's Cold War II prime terrain. The fallback position for the U.S., which possesses little potential to contain China after having been all but expelled from the Eurasia heartland, had to be a classic maritime power play. The free and open Indo-Pacific, complete with Quad and AUKUS. The whole setup spun to death as an effort to attempting to preserve dwindling American supremacy. The sharp contrast between the SCO continental integration drive and we all live in an OC submarine gambit speaks for itself. A toxic mix of hovering and desperation is in the air, with not even a whiff of pathos to alleviate the downfall. Glenn Dizen, professor at the University of Southeastern Norway and an editor at the Russia and Global Affairs Journal, is among the very few top scholars who are analyzing the process of Eurasia integration in depth. His latest book practically spells out the whole story in its title, Europe as the Western Peninsula of Greater Eurasia, Geoeconomic Regions in a Multipolar World. Dizen shows in detail how a Greater Eurasia region that integrates Asia and Europe is currently being negotiated and organized with a Chinese-Russian partnership at the center. Eurasian geoeconomic instruments of power are gradually forming the foundation of a super-region with new strategic industries, transportation corridors, and financial investments. Across the Eurasian continent, states as different as South Korea, India, Kazakhstan, and Iran are all advancing various formats for Eurasia integration. The Greater Eurasia Partnership has been at the center of Russian foreign policy, at least since the St. Petersburg Forum in 2016. Dizen duly notes that while Beijing and Moscow share the ambition to construct a larger Eurasian region, their formats differ. The comment denominator of both formats is the necessity of a Sino-Russian partnership to integrate Eurasia. That's what was made very clear at the Shanghai summit. It's no wonder the process irks the empire immensely, because Greater Eurasia, led by Russia-China, is a mortal attack against the geoeconomic architecture of Atlanticism. And that leads us to the nest of vipers debate around the EU concept of a strategic autonomy from the US that would be essential to establish true European sovereignty and eventually closer integration within Eurasia. European sovereignty is simply non-existent when its foreign policy means submission to dominatrix NATO. The humiliating unilateral withdrawal from Afghanistan, coupled with Anglo-only AUKUS, was a graphic illustration that the empire doesn't give a damn about European vessels. The book Dizen shows in detail how the concept of Eurasia unifying Europe and Asia have through history been an alternative to the dominance of maritime powers in the oceanic-centric world economy, and how British and American strategies have been deeply influenced by the ghost of an emerging Eurasia, a direct threat to their advantageous position in the oceanic world order. Now the crucial factor seems to be the fragmentation of Atlanticism. Deason identifies three levels: the de facto decoupling of Europe and the U.S. propelled by Chinese ascendancy, the mind-boggling internal divisions in the EU enhanced by the parallel universe inhabited by Brussels bureaucrats, and last but not the least, polarization within Western states caused by excesses of neoliberalism. Very few people, East and West, may remember that Washington had developed its own Silk Road concept during the Bill Clinton years, later co-opted by Dick Cheney, with a Pipeline-Lindstein twist, and then circling all back to Hillary Clinton, who announced her own Silk Road dream in India in 2011. Deason reminds us how Hillary sounded remarkably like a proto-she. Let's work together to create a new Silk Road, not a single through for like its namesake, but an international web and a network of economic and transit connections. That means building more rail lines, highways, energy infrastructure, like the proposed pipeline to run from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan through Pakistan and India, unquote. Hillary does Pipeline-Lichtenstein well. In the end, she didn't. Reality dictates that Russia is connecting its European and Pacific regions, while China connects its developed East Coast with Xinjiang, and both connects Central Asia. Deason interprets it as Russia completing its historical conversion from a European Slavic empire to a Eurasian civilizational state. So in the end, we are back to the Scythians. The prevailing Neo-Eurasia concept revives the mobility of nomadic civilizations via top transportation infrastructure to connect everything between Europe and Asia. We could call it the revenge of the heartland. They are the powers building this new interconnected Eurasia. Say goodbye to the ephemeral post-Cold War U.S. unipolar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to East Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. More extremist calls to kill Muslims in India. This time a video surfaced on social media, even with Hindu religious leaders calling for their people to arm themselves and kill Muslims. Now, of course, there are extremist elements all over the world, but the fact that the ruling leaders, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, remain silent during this racist and extremist call says a lot. Since Modi has taken over the country in 2014 as Prime Minister, India has turned from an ethnically diverse society to one of less tolerant and increased violence. But why? What's the goal? Stay with us on this Spotlight.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Hyderabad from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And the Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajareh, out of Qesh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, I'd like to start this off with Zafar. Thanks so much again for being with us. Do you think that the ruling party, BJP party, is specifically targeting Muslims? And if so, why would that be the case?
Absolutely. The ruling party's origins, and particularly those of Narendra Modi, are from a group called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, It's a fascist outfit. It has more than 6 million members, and their avowed aim is to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu society in which there is absolutely no room for other religious minorities, be they the 200 million Muslims or millions of Christians or even Dalits that constitute something like 200 million people. The BJP, the ruling party, operates at two levels. Number one, by polarizing the population, it believes that it can garner the support of the Hindu majority, which of course it is doing. But at the same time, it is beholden to these extremist groups that want to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu state in which there is no room for minorities, and that is also being pursued. If we look at the record of Modi since he became the Prime Minister in 2014, we see an alarming rise in anti-Muslim attacks in all parts of India, particularly around Delhi, places like Gurgaon and other places. Muslims are not given permission to build mosques. They are being targeted either because there are cow vigilantes who accuse Muslims of slaughtering cows, which is considered a sacred animal in India, or even accusing Muslim vendors, small vendors, of installing their push carts on roadsides, accusing them of blocking traffic when in fact there are no such allegations or accusations made against Hindus. Mm-hmm. So there are two aspects to this whole campaign. Number one, that Modi and his henchmen have found that polarizing the society garners them support in India because it's a majority Hindu country anyway, and therefore they don't care for the other people. It's not in that sense a true democracy. And number two, there is a very, very strong and dangerous movement in India that wants to turn India into a Hindu state.
Okay.
And that movement is actually supported by the ruling party, and that's the frightening part of it.
All right. Well, Masood, your take. You heard what Zafar said. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of this country with the size of it, and we're talking about Muslim population over 200 million. If that is the case, if actually Modi or BJP, they really want to turn us into a Hindu nation, I mean, what does that mean? How do they think that that can be accomplished, just looking at the sheer numbers?
It's very dangerous. I'm afraid this has been going now for quite a long time. It's going back even sort of before the new government being sworn in. I mean, in Gujarat, we had under governorship of Modi sort of ethnic cleansing and clashes and massacres of Muslims, which never dealt with appropriately, neither internationally or nationally within India. And this sort of Hindutva movement, which is pushing the idea of otherization and sort of concentrating on demonizing anyone who is not Hindu, it's getting strength. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's out of control. We are not just it, which has been going on and has been going on for a very long time, but we are actually seeing legislation after legislation discriminating against the Muslims in India on censorship and on even saying that any religious group could actually, from the neighboring country, could go to India and get sanctuary, except Muslims.
Right.
And so this exceptionalization against Muslims is going on, and I think international community, and indeed even the Muslim nations, are completely silent to this demonization. And even there are number of token Muslim leaders who's actually part of BJP and promoting this. And also, just to throw in, the situation of Kashmir, which is part of that demonization of Muslims and denying them the right is again very obvious and very clear. Something needs to be done on a matter of urgency.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Masood said that something needs to be done. I want to look at starting inside of the country itself. I mean, India likes to call itself the largest democracy in the world. How did this legislation, for example, the citizenship law, actually pass? I mean, in a country that says it's democratic and then has this very extremist elements that is growing. Tell me about the inside of the country and how this is allowed to happen.
Well, basically, what the BJP is doing is, as you pointed out, that it is enacting laws through parliament because the BJP has a majority in parliament. And this national citizenship law, which they have passed, which basically disenfranchises Muslims, and they can be essentially thrown out of the country. In fact, these are moves going on right now in India, in certain parts of India that they are enacting. Then there are other aspects. In fact, in the Indian constitution, for instance, says that all citizens have equal rights. But as far as the BJP is concerned, it does not believe in this. One of the BJP's leaders, Subramaniam Swamy, was being interviewed by Britain's Channel 4, and she asked him directly and said that your constitution says that all citizens have equal rights, so why are Muslims being persecuted? And Subramaniam Swamy openly said that we do not consider Muslims to be equal to Hindus, and therefore they cannot have equal rights. When you look at this situation, this is absolutely frightening that they are actually instituting laws to discriminate against Muslims and to consider them as being alien to that country. In fact, these Hindu extremist groups have made absolutely no secret of the fact that the Muslims must either convert to Hinduism or they have to be killed, as this recent meeting of December 17th to 19th that took place in Haridwar in India, and they categorically stated that we need to arm ourselves, that we need to start to kill Muslims, and we need to eliminate these Muslims. And when you look at the fact that Narendra Modi hasn't even uttered a word of condemnation of this, speaks volumes that he is actually encouraging and supporting this kind of attitude and behavior. And I'm afraid if serious action is not taken, first of all by Muslim countries, secondly by the larger international community, I am afraid that there is going to be a genocide of Muslims in India on such a horrendous scale that will boggle the mind. And I'm afraid this is where it is heading unless immediate action is taken.
Well, let's look at the international aspect to this, Masood. Do you see any action coming from the international community or Muslim communities you talked about earlier that there is not enough being done? What is being done, and what do you think should be done?
Well, really, nothing positive has been done. I mean, we have seen that some of these Persian Gulf countries like Bahrain and others have actually awarded Modi with the highest award and recognition. It's outrageous that this is happening at the time that so openly, so publicly, so institutionally, Muslims are being demonized and to the extent that the slaughtering of them, it is really becoming very obvious that if nothing is happening, then we are going to see ethnic cleansing and genocide against Muslims. And let us remember that this is going long way back. I mean, colonial power, Britain in particular, were involved in this divide and rule policy, which actually has already once resulted in genocide of hundreds and millions of people in India in the partition time. And now this new ideology and Hinduism is an ideology which is fixed on sort of ethnic cleansing, fixed on sort of supremacy, and fixed on sort of promoting this. And, you know, it's being promoted very systematically. You know, their supporters, the United States, are becoming powerful and locked by. And so I can't see anything is going to happen automatically. We need to bring awareness. And, you know, India is going down a route which I think genocide and ethnic cleansing is just around the corner. Hmm. And I'm not being sort of alarmist. This is actually what is happening. And even the Muslim world and countries are absolutely in daydreaming while this is taking place.
Well, Zafar, we know that India has been getting closer and closer to the Zionist regime, Israel. I mean, when hearing some of the things that you were saying and also Masoud was saying, it was like out of the Israeli playbook, some of the issues that the Muslims are facing now in India. Your assessment of that, do you see any similarities to what is taking place and perhaps Israeli influence in this, or your assessment of that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. The Indian fascists, the Hindutva fascists, are actually following the Israeli model completely. What the Zionists are doing to the Palestinian people in Palestine, this is precisely what these Hindutva fascists are doing to Muslims in India, except that the scale is much larger in India, because in India we have at least 200 million Muslims. You know, I would echo exactly what Masoud said, that these anti-Muslim pogroms and riots have been going on since day one of the creation of India. But since the BJP came to power, it has escalated alarmingly, because these fascist groups now have a state at their disposal. And let me give you some examples. For instance, the police force in India, in most parts of India, are infested by these Hindutva fascists. So when Muslims are being targeted, even if they go to lodge a complaint, the police don't pay any attention. You look at the latest example that happened on December 17th to 19th, when a complaint was lodged, although evidence was presented to the police that look at these Hindu fascists that are openly declaring that they should arm themselves and perpetrate a genocide against the Muslims, only one person has been charged out of an entire group of thousands that were involved in that. That gives you an indication of the level of infiltration that has taken place of these fascist elements. The same thing applies to the bureaucracy in India. You go everywhere and you see that today Muslims are, first of all, deprived of their economic rights. Now they're being deprived of their political rights, and they're actually being killed, and very little is being done inside India. So we see that the playbook that the Zionists are following in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, is being repeated in India. I want to add one other point, and that is that India is now considered an ally of the United States and of the West in general, because they want to target China and they want to rope in India on their side. In the United States, there is an organization called the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom. For 2 years in a row, 2020 and 2021, this organization called upon the U.S. State Department to say that India is a country of concern because of religious persecution of minorities, and the State Department should put it on its list. For 2 years in a row, the State Department has categorically refused to do so, claiming and stating that just because India is an ally, that we would not do such a thing. So I'm afraid we are facing a very, very serious situation whereby regrettably, neither the Muslim countries nor the broader international community is going to do anything about it. And that is why I said that there is a very, very serious risk of a genocide of Muslims taking place in India.
Masoud, you had mentioned Kashmir earlier. And again, when I talk about that comparison between what the Israeli regime is doing, and we look at Kashmir, that situation, and how at one point in time they were able to keep their land and just other Muslims from the region could. But now Modi, with the law that was passed, actually allows anyone to go in there. And we see an unbelievable crackdown on Kashmir. My question is, do you think there is going to be blowback for all of this inside of India from what is being done in Kashmir, from what is being done inside of India to the minority communities in general, as Zafar had pointed out? The Muslims are 200 million. There are also Christians and others. Do you think that we're going to see some type of reaction from within India, or does pressure have to come from outside?
I think the pressure has to come from outside and inside the combined. The reality is that they have, I mean, as I mentioned, Gujarat massacre was a sort of an exercise to see if they could get away with it. It happened at the time that they weren't in absolute power, but nevertheless, with all the evidence which was there, and we presented an extensive report on it from IHRC, but nothing was done. They got away with it. They're getting away with it in Kashmir, and they're getting away with all these demonization publicly from very high up within the Indian society. They're getting away with it. That is really what makes it very clear that, you know, we are at a very, very dangerous sort of time. Something needs to be done urgently, internationally and nationally. And I'm afraid we can't hold our breath and wait for the OIC to do anything. They've never done anything for anyone. But I think we need to sort of expose what is happening is going to be creating one of the greatest sort of genocide, which, you know, which has taken place. And until unless something will be done urgently, and I emphasize urgently, then we are well already in the way of that genocide, and all the preparation for it, all the tests, and all the you know, the situation of Kashmir and the change of the laws against the constitution and so forth, they're all in place for this fascist system to go into the full scale and create that sort of genocide. And we need to really ring the alarm bells all over and ring it in such a way that this sort of genocide, that level in a place like India, is going to be so devastating, not just for Indian Muslims, but for everyone in the region and beyond.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Zafar Bangash, from the Institute, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and out of Qesh, lucky you, Masood Shahjadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission.